Greetings once again to all of you out there from right here in the middle of it all. You may have heard the news, but stand by now for the World View. That's right, it is the Weekly World View. I am your host, Doug McBurney, and I'm so glad to have you back on the show where we don't take calls, we don't tolerate sponsors, but we do focus on the events of the week through the lens of original thought, and we've got a lot of justice and culture news, a lot of violence and bloodshed and death, and some fun stuff, too. So stay tuned. You will not be displeased. Not sure where I want to start today. I want to start today with the realization that I had earlier in the day that all of civilized culture is really quite a thin veneer, and it is fragile. It is fragile, and we will see that from today's news, and I'm sure that you will experience that in your life as you go forward and come to the realization that I have. That everything you think is solid, everything you've taken for granted, could change dramatically and suddenly. And so you've got to have a prepared heart and spirit and soul. Don't reject a biblical foundation for your life, because that is the only rock that will endure. Everything else will wash away with the tide. I shouldn't say will. Everything else could wash away with the tide. So prepare your hearts. Choose you this day what you will believe, what you will say. Let's start with justice. O.J. Simpson rearing his ugly head, and I don't mean just to Bubba at the Nevada State Penitentiary. I mean in the news. This came from the New York Daily News. I'm not sure if it's a stellar source of news, but it is what it is. And here's what we've got in the O.J. Simpson line of storytelling, I suppose. This is from the New York Daily News. In a 46-page document posted on his website, lawyer F. Lee Bailey wrote that he had additional evidence that would finally erase all doubt about O.J. Simpson's innocence. That's right, F. Lee Bailey, in the 15 years since the O.J. Simpson trial, has apparently figured it all out, and says he's pretty shocked. Well, I'll read from his own words. I won't put words in Mr. Bailey's mouth. But some of you in the audience may not be aware, although I'm sure almost all of you are, that in 1999, was it? 98? Back when O.J. was found guilty in the civil trial and ordered to pay some tens of millions of dollars to the family of the people whose heads he cut off, I went out to Los Angeles with my boss at the time, Bob Enyart, radio host, and we purchased O.J.'s memorabilia and his jerseys, and we burned them on the steps of the L.A. County Courthouse. It was quite the adventure. What hotel was that we stayed in? That was a nice hotel. Seemed really nice back then, but what did we know? We'd never been in a nice hotel at that point in our career. Anyway, it was... What's that? Days Inn. Was it Days Inn? No, it was somewhere downtown, way high up. Anyway, but... So you may or may not know where I stand on the guilt or innocence of O.J. Simpson. I think he's guilty of sin, and I think he should have been put to death. And I can honestly say that I was at my workplace when the verdict was read. And I can tell you that that was a turning point in my life. It was at that point when the verdict was read and I felt that sick feeling deep down in my stomach. It was at that moment in my young life that I realized that my nation was in deep trouble. I realized something was terribly, terribly wrong. that this man could get away with murder and bamboozle a relatively ignorant jury and walk away scot-free with blood on his hands, I knew that there was some serious problems.
You should have mentioned that you used to be his big fan.
And I should mention that. There was not a bigger fan. Well, there probably were bigger fans, people who paint their faces and whatnot. But I was born in Buffalo. Grew up in Buffalo till I was 9 years old. Was a Buffalo Bills fan. Moved to Texas in 1977 at the tender age of 9. And I was harassed brutally by Dallas Cowboys fans over O.J. Simpson and the Buffalo Bills. And I hate the Dallas Cowboys to this day. But there's only one thing I hate worse than the Dallas Cowboys, and that's O.J. Simpson. O.J. Simpson's trial and acquittal, criminal trial and acquittal, simply revealed to me the state of justice in our nation and set me on a lifelong journey to figure out what the hell is going on with our justice system. And I'm still trying to figure it out. But apparently F. Lee Bailey has figured it out. Bailey has published this 46-page document on his website. He says he may turn the document into a book. Okay, so now we know why this made news. He's thinking about a book deal. And he says that despite what the public might believe about his former client, Simpson simply wasn't the type of person to use, quote, raging violence to solve his emotional problems, unquote. Yeah, that's what I said. He wasn't the type, that's all. You know, whenever someone commits murder in the neighborhood and the news media goes and interviews the neighbors, what do all the neighbors say? Oh, we knew he was going to kill somebody. It was just a matter of time. You could tell with that guy. No, that's never what they say. They say he just wasn't the type. He was quiet. He was nice. He walked his dog, mowed his yard. You would have never thunk it. Anyway, OJ fits that description perfectly. Bailey writes, now get this. I believe he wrote this with a straight face. OJ, apart from the infliction of injury on Nicole, has no history of resorting to raging violence to solve his emotional problems. And Bailey points out that a psychiatrist agreed that O.J. had never been psychotic. And Bailey says that Simpson's suicide attempt in the back of the white Bronco that summer afternoon when we all watched him on TV, Simpson's suicide attempt was caused by distress over the death of a loved one. Is that right, F. Lee? Okay, what else does Mr. Bailey say in his prologue to a book deal on his website? Bailey says, the majority of my otherwise intelligent and thoughtful friends have a knee-jerk certainty of O.J.'s guilt. My otherwise intelligent and thoughtful friends, he says, have this knee-jerk reaction. Bailey presents the following arguments to prove Simpson didn't kill his wife. Okay, here's his first line of, what do they call it in legal circles? The first line of questioning, I don't know if that's appropriate. Anyway, here's the first line of evidence. He says the infamous Bronco chase wasn't actually a chase, but would better be classified as a high-tension escort by the police, I suppose, to O.J.'s mom's house. I can't remember where he ended up. So that was a high-tension escort. Second line of evidence, O.J.'s demeanor wasn't one of a killer. He seemed friendly to attendants and a pilot on a flight that he was on hours after the murders. And here's his next line of evidence. A dog walker said he saw a blonde woman arguing with a man near a white pickup truck the night of the murder with another man crouching 70 feet away. The dog walker says he didn't think anything of it until he learned of the murders the following day. Well, that doesn't seem to help his case. Somebody was crouching. Let's see. Next line of evidence. A key witness who was never called would have testified that Simpson wasn't jealous of other men's relationships with his ex-wife. Yeah, I'm sure that didn't bother O.J. at all. The mother of his children out there gallivanting with cokeheads and weirdos out there in L.A., that didn't bother O.J. at all. No. Bailey says he didn't publish the evidence to clear his client in the public eye because he felt people were too biased following the explosive trial. He says, quote, I had always decided to move forward but was convinced it would take time until anyone has an open mind and might think about buying my book. Anyway, but Effley Bailey makes a good point. He says it would take time until anyone has an open mind. You know, I've always said justice delayed is justice denied. And one thing that devious attorneys can count on in criminal cases is that if enough time goes by, people forget the details and they're willing to believe almost anything. Effley's absolutely right about that. That's why the Innocence Project has so much success in digging up the minutiae of these decades-old cases, is because no one really remembers what happened. And when you're just going through a box of paperwork about a case, and the blood is dry, and the victims are in the grave, and the families of the victims have grown old and died, it's quite easy to bamboozle the relatively ignorant masses. People don't have time to focus on the minutiae of a 30-year-old crime. They're working and living and raising children. And so these devious lawyers take advantage of their ignorance as time goes by. And I believe Effley Bailey is about to do just that. We'll find out who gives Effley a book deal to prove O.J. was it. Didn't O.J. write a book, How I Did It?
Yeah.
I thought that kind of mitigates against Effley's theories. But, hey, you know, you got a book to sell, Effley. Get out there. Get it done. All right, let's move on. As I told you, O.J.'s acquittal was a turning point in my life, and I began to read the news, and I began to talk more and more about the state of domestic tranquility in the country, the fact that the home life of America has become violent and blood-soaked in so many cases. Case in point, Dateline Novi, Michigan. From the Associated Press, a man killed his wife and two children in the bedrooms of their Southeast Michigan home before apparently committing suicide in his truck in a Walmart parking lot. Police reported this on Friday. Officers found the body of Jennifer Shones, 38, the couple's two sons, Tynan and Camden, just 6 and 4 years old, in their beds. A family friend had reported the children hadn't come to school. The mother had missed an appointment. Sheriff's deputies found Mark Shones, 39 years old, dead of a self-inflicted gunshot wound in his vehicle hours later. There is no documented criminal history or police contact involving this family, according to authorities. So certainly Mr. Shones didn't have the demeanor of a killer. Family members and friends said the couple had been considering divorce. And police say that they described this incident as an isolated incident in an otherwise safe community there in Novi, Michigan. I would beg to differ. I don't know that any community is safe in America anymore. We've almost become numb to the level of violence that's all around us. I mean, if I wanted to, I could get on the air every day and talk about just the murders, the rapes, the muggings, the stabbings, the clubbings, and the beatings just here in the Denver metro area, if I wanted to. One could do a 3-hour daily broadcast just on that, if one chose to do so. And I was clued into all this when O.J. walked free. It's as if the scales fell from my eyes, and I knew that something was terribly wrong. Dateline Prince George's County. Federal agents are embedding with homicide investigators in Prince George's County, I believe that's Virginia, starting this week, in a rare move as authorities scramble to react to a string of 13 killings that have occurred since January 1st, 2011. Yeah, Prince George's County's 13 killings exceed the military deaths that have occurred this year in Afghanistan, at least as of last Friday morning when this story went to print. So you've heard me bombastically comparing the streets of America to the war zones in the Middle East, and I was right all along. The comparison is not accurate because the streets of America are far more violent. All right. More from the domestic tranquility file. I cannot do this yet. Can I? Well, I'm going to do it. All right. You all saw the picture of Jared Loughner, his smirk to the camera. This man who shot and killed 6 people, injured 14 others, smirked for the camera on his mugshot, and that seems to annoy, even the left seems to be annoyed at him. And I tell you, watching this story this week made it almost impossible for me to watch or listen to TV, radio, or even read any news, because I couldn't decide which was more disconcerting, the left trying to imply that the right was responsible, or the right trying to defend themselves against the feckless arguments of the heathen, godless, antichrist left. It was annoying on both sides. But why did I pull this story? Oh, here we go. Every federal judge in the Southern District of Arizona has recused themselves from the case because one of Loughner's alleged victims was federal judge John Roll. Okay, now last week I pronounced this fella's name, this Jared Loughner. I pronounced it Loner, and I don't know why, if there was a typo or if I just misread it. You know, you throw in too many extra vowels in the middle of a word, and sometimes I miss it. I called him Jared Loner, which may have been more appropriate than I thought at the time. Anyway, the point being, every federal judge has recused themselves because they knew one of the victims, proving that these judges do not understand the principles of justice, or the principles that should underlie justice. One of the principles of justice is to cleanse the persons most affected of their anger and their pain and their bitterness and their desire for revenge by allowing them to participate in the trial. And all these judges are, well, they don't get it. But are we shocked? Anyway, talk all week. What was the motive? What was his motive? Was it the Tea Party? Was it the Daily Kos? What was the motive here? Well, let me give you my simple analysis of a simple man. Here, Jared Loughner was genuinely mentally deranged, which doesn't excuse his crime. It means he should be put down like a mad dog, like the mad dog that he is. Jared Loughner hated Jesus Christ. That's the primary motivation, in my opinion, because his hatred of Jesus Christ led him to hate himself and to hate other people. And when he came to a point in his fragile, disoriented, deranged mind where he realized he wanted to die, when he came to that point, in his worldview, killing others first naturally followed that desire to die. So there's his motive. Hatred of Jesus Christ. Why did he do it? That's the other question all week. We've struggled with it. Folks on CNN have practically broken down in tears over this question. Why? 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 Why would Jared Loughner come to that point where he wants not only to die, but to kill? And I would posit that it's because our culture promotes killing to solve perceived problems. Our government, our schools, movies, TV, music promotes sexual freedom. And this deranged, warped vision of sexual freedom can warp a selfish and unstable young man, leading him to perceive there's a problem in his sexually screwed up life. And so he ends up turning to what his culture has taught him, which is that it's okay to kill people to solve your problems. So that's why he did it. And what was the trigger? That's the big question. Sean Hannity wants to know. Rush Limbaugh wants to know. Chris Matthews wants to know. Anderson Cooper wants to know. Arianna Huffington wants to know, what was the trigger that set Jared Loughner off? And I think it's painfully obvious to everyone that Jared Loughner himself pulled the trigger.
The devil says.
Hey, That's right. Just as we suspected from the very beginning, it was Jared Loughner himself who was the trigger. And he is solely to blame, although this incident should cause us to re-examine our culture. Not necessarily our political demeanor and the use of certain terms and phrases in political campaigns and political communication. But it should cause us to examine the culture that produced this young man. And by the way, I want to talk about the congresswoman who was shot, whatever her name was. I did some research on her. And I just want to point out the dark irony that has not yet been pointed out in any media outlet that I'm aware of. And the dark irony is that as, what was her name? Gabrielle Giffords, the congresswoman from Arizona. As she stood next to Christine Green, 9-year-old, innocent little girl, Christine Green had no idea that while she was in the womb in 2001, we've all heard that Christine Green was born on September 11th, 2001. That's right. And what Christine Green did not know as she stood next to Gabrielle Giffords was that Gabrielle Giffords had actively advocated the right to kill Christine Green in 2001 when Christine Green was in her mother's womb. Gabrielle Giffords has been active in politics in Arizona since 2001 when she entered the Arizona State House as a representative, where she has been known as an advocate of legalized child killing. So the reason I find it hard to shed a tear for Gabrielle Giffords is because one of the victims for whom we all cried, Christine Green, that 9-year-old innocent little girl, Gabrielle Giffords actively advocated her murder 10 years ago, back in 2001, when Christine Green was in the most dangerous place for a child in America. The most dangerous place for a child in America, which is in her mother's womb, where Christine Green could not speak up and tell anyone she wanted to live, while Gabrielle Giffords built a political career actively advocating the murder of Christine Green. So all these politicians who have this nebulous pro-choice view and they're pro-choice advocates, they're talking about murdering Christine Green. There's your face on the issue, ladies and gentlemen. I have a 9-year-old daughter, so I was choked up when I heard that this little 9-year-old girl had been murdered and that this politician who actively advocated her murder had lived. Giffords, according to my research, Giffords' position has been that abortion should always be legally available. She voted yes to expand funding of embryonic stem cell research. She supports providing, quote, emergency contraception, unquote, at military facilities. She is endorsed by Emily's List for pro-choice Democratic women. Giffords supported the Prevention First Act back in 2007. That act, among other things, made the argument that without abortion funding, babies may be abused or die. The act read, quote, "A child born from an unintended pregnancy is at greater risk of low birth weight, dying in the first year of life, being abused, and not receiving sufficient resources for healthy development." So Gabrielle Giffords has supported legalized child killing from the very beginning of her short political career. And it's a sick and dark irony that we weep for Christine Green in the same breath that we weep for one who advocated her murder. And I honestly hope as jaded as I am, I honestly hope that Gabrielle Giffords, now having come face to face with her own mortality, will repent of her wicked and criminal advocacy of the killing of children, just like Christine Green. I'll pray for that. Join me if you care to. And we shall see how it turns out. Now let's turn, appropriately enough, to the personhood file from Denver, Colorado. 1 month after an unborn child died at the hands of a hit-and-run driver, one Colorado legislator is working on a bill that would criminalize fetal homicide. This is Representative Mark Waller, a state congressman out of Colorado Springs. He says, quote, "We have a hole in our statute. You can commit a crime against an unborn child and completely get away with it. There is no charge related to that unborn child," unquote. Couldn't agree more, Mr. Waller. Definitely got a hole in our statute. The mother, if you don't live in the Denver metro area, this is a story that has occupied the headlines for quite some time. The young mother, Laura Gorham's 34-week-old fetus, died this past December 9th when the pregnant woman was struck by a car in a Denver neighborhood. Under state law, the driver of the vehicle, if found and arrested, could not be charged with the unborn child's death. Representative Waller said fetuses deserve the same protection in cases of homicide or other crimes as human beings do. But abortion rights supporters are worried that such attempts would help define unborn children as people and would jeopardize a woman's right to butcher her unborn child. Oh, I'm sorry. They said it would jeopardize a woman's right to choose. And pro-choice advocates have helped defeat similar bills in the past. And you might wonder why. Well, it's because they're in the fetal homicide industry. Now, I know that the news media likes to portray that the forces fighting against pro-lifers are really just liberation-minded women, and that most women agree. But every time I pick up a story and read the other side's statements against personhood or any pro-life position, it always seems like it's a broken tape recorder. And here we go again. We have a quote from the pro-choice side. Her name is Monica McCafferty, and guess who she works for? Can we guess who she might work for? She's a spokesperson for Planned Parenthood of Colorado. That's the biggest child-killing organization in the state of Colorado. They rake in the most money butchering and burning and killing little children. Well, Monica McCafferty says, well, this bill could open the door for personhood, and Colorado voters have rejected that twice. She also said, anything that could outlaw abortion or open the door to establishing personhood is something we'd be concerned about, unquote. So every time, it's always Planned Parenthood. Why does anybody, has anybody recognized a pattern here? That there's no general outcry on the part of the masses to stop killing children? It's this same bunch of, what does Savage call them? Clenched-jawed, clipped-haired, feminist Nazi types who are fighting against personhood. And when the day comes that legalized child killing is abandoned, finally, in America, and the nation takes a deep breath and looks back upon our history, we're going to wonder, how was it that we were manipulated by a bunch of deranged madwomen, hell-bent on destroying innocent life? And we're going to realize at some point not long after that, that they were under the control of wicked and evil men. Thank you. You know, I've often asked friends and associates, who do you think it was that first came up with the idea of killing a child in his mother's womb? Do you think it was the mother, or do you think it was some man manipulating her? And a lot of people don't seem to have followed my line of thinking. I'm certain it was a man. A man who was either going to be embarrassed or his political or social position was threatened. And so he manipulated the woman. He lied to the woman. And that lie has persisted. Anyway, back to Representative Mark Waller, Colorado Springs. Waller met last week with a representative from Planned Parenthood and has also consulted with Right to Life supporters. He said he wants to find a middle ground that will satisfy both camps. So while Mr. Waller, I appreciate your efforts. He's also, the article also says Planned Parenthood is optimistic that such language can be found. Mr. Waller, if you find language that ameliorates the concerns of Planned Parenthood, my friend, you have been manipulated. You have been lied to. And it will all be for naught. How do you find a middle ground between the people who want to kill children and the people who want them to stop? It would seem to me that's a pretty precarious place to search for middle ground. Mr. Waller, I would be much more satisfied with your statement if you simply said, these are my convictions, this is what I know to be right, and this is what I shall do. But he's a congressman, so anyway. All right. Now, I'm halfway through the show. I've got to go rapid fire now here, ladies and gentlemen. So you're going to have to listen quickly. From Las Vegas, the Domestic Tranquility File. Jason Griffith, a 32-year-old man, has admitted that he killed Deborah Flores Navarez, a 31-year-old woman, in the heat of the moment after an argument at his Las Vegas home on December 12th. Flores Navarez was reported missing December 14th. She told her friend she was going over to Griffith's house on December 12th. She and Griffith argued, and he choked her, chopped her into pieces, covered her body with cement. They had an argument. Did you get that? An argument, then he choked her, chopped her up, and covered her body with cement. That's state of domestic tranquility in Las Vegas. Police had responded to a domestic violence call involving the couple back in October. She told the police at the time that she was pregnant with Griffith's child. Not to put too fine a point on things, but there you have it. Now, from the Justice File, from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, more than 1,100 registered sex offenders live and work in Allegheny County. 43 of them are now wearing GPS monitoring devices as a condition of their parole. Officials say as long as the offenders stay in what are called inclusion areas, they're okay. But if they travel into an exclusion area, police are notified immediately. Now, I know, it's bizarre. Exclusion zones are schools, daycares, playgrounds, and facilities where children congregate. That's an exclusion zone. Inclusion zones are apparently everywhere else. And so the police say we've identified the red zones, and if an offender with a device goes into one of those red zones, an exclusion zone will be notified immediately. And police claim they can now watch these predators 24/7. Yeah, right. Well, I'm not buying that, first of all, that the police can watch anyone 24/7. I don't care if you give them a bracelet. I mean, how many police do you have monitoring the screens, and how many do you have on the street? Do you have enough to keep up with 1,100 sex offenders? Now, I'm sure they're not all child molesters. But let's talk specifically about child molesters, because this really, really gets to me. First of all, the exclusion zone for a child molester should be anywhere on the surface of the earth. They should be welcome anywhere beneath the surface of the earth. And we should encourage that they be put there as soon as possible. But the exclusion zone should be fairly universal. But who is it, ladies and gentlemen, that is profiting either financially or psychologically by keeping child molesters alive? I don't remember when this happened. When we all agreed that we would tolerate child molesters. I just don't remember when that happened. I probably wasn't politically sentient at the time. But I strongly disagree. And this is what I believe. And I will advocate for the swift and painful death penalty of all child molesters. And I don't think that is should be a very controversial issue. But who is it that made this decision? I've been pondering this. Let me throw a few things out, and then if you have any thoughts, I'd be glad to entertain them. Is it the prison industry? I thought about that. There's a pretty big prison industry. Lots of people are employed, construction projects, lifetime tenure for people in the prison industry, pensions and all that. They're all on the line. But then I realized that the gargantuan prison industry we have is not what could drive something like this. It's simply the result of a justice system preserving the lives of wicked, evil people who should be put to death. So while I generally despise the prison industry, I understand that it's an industry like many others, and that it's not necessarily responsible for its own existence. It simply exists due to other factors outside the control of the poor slob who becomes a prison guard. I believe, this is my theory. I believe that it is guilt-ridden lawyers and judges working in the justice system who know that they themselves are so evil that it's hypocritical for them to execute anyone, even a child molester. That's what I believe has led to the preservation of these monsters. And now we're tracking them with GPS. It's ridiculous. Exclusion zones, red zones, 24/7. It's ridiculous. And I believe that's from whence it comes. Because it's kind of hard to pronounce the death penalty on someone when you know yourself that you're guilty of it and you deserve it. And I think that's what most lawyers and judges struggle with on a daily basis, and the way they've dealt with it is to eliminate the death penalty for just about everything. All right. Now let's move into the politics file. This is from CBS News. A new poll finds that Americans strongly prefer cutting spending to raising taxes to reduce the federal deficit. Here are the numbers, folks. 77% prefer to cut spending, and only 9% call for raising taxes. That's from CBS. Can I just ask the question, what if those numbers were reversed? What if 77% were calling for raising taxes and benefits, and only 9% were calling for cutting spending? Who would be right if the numbers were reversed? Might I say, ladies and gentlemen, that a poll is an ass. It is meaningless. It simply carries the agenda of whoever cracks the whip on it. But it's just an ass, and it should be ignored. All right. Here we go. More from the politics file. From Washington, D.C., the Associated Press. Amid its struggle to contain damage from the WikiLeaks revelations, the State Department announced last week that it is promoting a documentary film that celebrates Pentagon Papers leaker Daniel Ellsberg. That's right. The film is called The Most Dangerous Man in America, Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers. And it's been selected by folks working for the State Department as one of 18 films that will tour the world this year as part of the State Department's American Documentary Showcase program. Now, you'll remember who Daniel Ellsberg was. He was the one who Xeroxed thousands of copies of classified Pentagon documents and leaked them to undermine support for the Vietnam War. Maybe you don't remember that, but I do. So I see an irony here. Ellsberg, by the way, is also a champion of PFC Bradley Manning, the homosexual leaker. He's a leaker, probably in more ways than one. Well, that's just disgusting to think about. Why would I say that? Anyway, Manning's apparently not doing any leaking while he's in prison, awaiting trial. Let's see. The Barry Ho administration has not gone to court against PFC Manning, oddly enough, as the Nixon White House did back during the Pentagon Papers case back in 1971. But there you have it. The State Department decries Assange and Manning and WikiLeaks the same week they're promoting a film honoring Daniel Ellsberg, the last person to undermine U.S. foreign policy in such a heinous way. By the way, a little bit more from the Associated Press. Among the other documentaries chosen for this year's showcase are If a Tree Falls, a story of the Earth Liberation Front, which deals with a radical environmental group that has been regarded as a terrorist organization, at least when they burn down buildings. And then some other movies about civil rights advocates and something about Allen Iverson, oddly enough. Anyway, a dark. It's a week of dark irony. That's the only way I can put it, folks. And when enough dark ironies start turning up, you have to sit and hold on to your seat and wonder what is about to happen. What the hell is going on, I like to say. And I don't mean that in a profane manner. I mean that in the sense that it's as if hell is bubbling to the surface. Hell is cracking through the thin veneer that holds civilized society together. And it's a little scary. And speaking of that, let's go to Tunisia, with their capital city of Tunis. Not very creative folks over there. The name of the country is Tunisia. What's the capital? Tunis. Okay. Anyway, their president, Ben Ali, has fled to Saudi Arabia following a month of anti-government violent protests that has claimed dozens of lives. Gangs of men fired weapons randomly from speeding cars in the capital. Clouds of black smoke hung over the city from burning buildings. This is according to Reuters. The ousting of Tunisia's president after widespread protests could embolden Arab opposition movements and ordinary people to challenge entrenched governments across the Middle East. Well, I think that's a bit of a rosy scenario. Could it be the explosion of democracy by popular demand that George Bush envisioned in his Bush Doctrine is beginning to erupt? I don't think so, folks. It's one twisted, sick Muslim burning and looting the home of another sick, twisted Muslim so that he can put his sick, twisted Muslim friends in charge and further enslave the people. Well, that's just my... I know, I'm a pessimist. I warned you about that. In the Gaza Strip, hundreds of Islamic Jihad supporters rallied to support the uprising. So if the Islamic Jihadists are on the side of the people who ousted the president, I'd want to look at the president's credentials again before I agreed to back their popular movement. I've never been a big fan of mass popular movements anyway. All right, now, I'm getting behind here. One more from the war file. U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates says China's rapidly developing defense capabilities are worrisome to the United States. That's what Robert Gates says. It's nice of him to notice. I mean, I've been pointing this out for 10 years. It's nice of Robert Gates. I always figured he was a pretty smart fellow. As I've reported here, China is on track to develop their own aircraft carrier. They have a new stealth fighter jet, a new ballistic missile that could explode an aircraft carrier from 2,000 miles away. So Gates is starting to take notice. Gates, according to The Guardian, the newspaper from which I gleaned this story, Gates was in Beijing last week for talks about these and other weapons and other military issues with Chinese leaders and to fundamentally grovel and make sure that they buy our bonds at the next auction. Chinese leaders say, quote,
"We do not pose a threat, and our military forces are purely for defense, including deterring Taiwan from declaring formal independence."
That's a Chinese official. I believe we were the only crew to have microphones there. Now, according to The Guardian, in an apparent nod to U.S. calls for more openness, China allowed video and pictures last week of runway tests of its prototype stealth fighter. I love how these poor ignorant reporters at The Guardian act as if China is responding to our call for openness when what China is actually doing is rattling a saber right in front of our face by showing us their stealth fighter. Thank you very much, Mr. Obama. Come over here. We want to be open. Look, we have new stealth fighter. Very nice, isn't it? All right. Now, I heard that this is true, and I believe we have some tape, but we understand that Secretary of Defense Gates asked some of his Chinese counterparts there If any of Sun Tzu's writings could offer any advice on how to integrate open homosexuals into an army during a time of two war fronts. And I believe that we were the only ones who had microphones there when the Chinese official answered him. Go ahead and roll that.
Yes, Mr. Gates, in regard to your question about homosexuality, and this is very difficult for me to say to you, Mr. Gates, but please listen. Regarding the homosexuals, the Chinese military in China, we don't roll like that.
I would dance and be merry, life would be a ding-a-dairy if I only had a brain.
All right. I think that works for Secretary of Defense Gates. That's pretty good. All right. Now, ladies and gentlemen, not to bum you out, but let's go to the economy file. Home values have fallen 26% since their peak in June 2006, and that is the steepest decline. That eclipses the 25.9% decline seen during the Great Depression years of 1928 to 1933. November of 2010 marked the 53rd consecutive month. That's 4.5 years, for those of you doing the math, that home values have fallen. Home values are expected to continue to slide as inventories pile up and likely won't recover until the job market improves. This is all from CNBC, so take it for what it's worth. They're not exactly the greatest source of accurate information, but hey, it is what it is, okay? I don't want to depress you, but I hope you don't need to sell a house. That's all. One more from the war file. This is from the New York Times. Over the past 2 years, according to intelligence and military experts, the Dimona complex in the Negev Desert, which is the famous, heavily guarded heart of Israel's alleged nuclear program. over there at Dimona, they've taken on a new secret role as a critical testing ground in a joint American and Israeli effort to undermine Iran's effort to make a bomb. Apparently, some experts say that Dimona, that military defense and intelligence officials at the Dimona site tested the effectiveness of the Stuxnet computer worm, a destructive program that appears to have wiped out roughly a fifth of Iran's nuclear centrifuges and helped delay, though not destroy, Tehran's ability to make its first nuclear device. This New York Times story says the virus was designed as an American-Israeli project to sabotage Iran. How did the New York Times get a hold of this information? I'm pretty disappointed in whoever these intelligence officials are. You'd think they'd want to keep something like this secret and not leak it to a disreputable rag like the New York Times, but there you have it. On into the culture file as we round third. We're headed for homes here. Did I say homes? We're headed for home. The U.S. Second Circuit Court of Appeals, according to the New York Post, has vacated the fines that the FCC levied against ABC after the network violated broadcast indecency standards by showing an actress's naked behind during an episode of NYPD Blue. When overturning the fine, the court cited the FCC's own declaration that, quote, nudity itself is not per se indecent, unquote. All right, so you FCC officials who say that, what I would like you to do is I would like you to disrobe on television in front of 30 million people and say that.
Well, nudity itself is not per se indecent.
As you stand there naked in front of 30 million people on TV. What's that? Oh, it's a broadcast network, ABC? Okay. All right, in front of 5 million people. It's indecent, okay? You would feel uncomfortable if you had to do that, Mr. FCC bureaucrat. According to Lawrence Myers, the editor of Inside the TV Writers Room, and an editor for something called Picket Fences, which I have no idea what that is. I'm sure it does not involve actually building picket fences. He says the result of this latest ruling is that it means we're going to get more nudity. He says they're going to show bare buns on the screen now, basically. He says network ratings are in severe decline and have been for a number of years. What else does he say? He says, and it's not just going to be more nudity, but it'll be showing sexual pleasure or showing a little more violent content that you might have seen before. Every little push forward, you might call it a micro-calibration, unquote. That's according to some TV huckster. So that's what we're in for. As the network's ratings circle the drain, they'll do anything. They probably show murder live on the air if they could make a buck, and they're certainly not above showing sex. All right, so there you have it. More from the culture file. Oh, this is absolutely what you would expect. Public school dad Eric Greenleaf, who said at a meeting of parents at a New York public school, what are they called? I don't even know. I don't deal with the public schools. I've forgotten. The school board meeting. He said at a meeting of parents and officials at State Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver's downtown office that there will be, quote, huge shortages, unquote, of classroom space in lower Manhattan in the coming years. So here's a dad pointing out to the school administrators, the bureaucracy, and all of those people that we're running out of space. So public school chancellor Kathy Black said, quote, could we just have some birth control for a while? It could really help us all out a lot. That's what the chancellor said. She also dropped jaws later at the meeting by likening her task of satisfying space crunch concerns in every neighborhood to making, quote, many Sophie's Choices, unquote. Do you remember Sophie's Choice? That's a reference to a book in which the mother of an Auschwitz death camp is forced to decide which of her two children will live. That's what a school chancellor, Kathy Black, said. Right in front of God and everybody at a meeting. After initially declining to comment, Department of Education spokeswoman Natalie Ravitz emphasized that Black takes the issue of crowded schools seriously, which is what prompted her participation in the monthly task force meeting. She takes it so seriously that I'm certain that she advocates for the killing of unborn children so that they'll have more space in the overcrowded New York City schools. Do you want to bet that school's chancellor, Kathy Black, is pro-child killing? Do you want to bet? I'd be willing to bet everything I have. All right. And so sometimes people's wicked and evil interior sometimes cracks through that thin veneer that you and I think make everybody civilized and treat each other with respect and dignity. But there are those in the government and in business and in culture and society in general who are like crouching tigers just waiting to devour what they can, ladies and gentlemen. So when that veneer cracks and crumbles, well, things can get pretty ugly. So get your heart right with your Creator. Do not reject a biblical foundation for your life, and do not trample underfoot the promises of Jesus Christ. And you will survive, you will prevail. If you do not, you will be consumed in the fire that is coming. All right. From Memphis, Tennessee, from WMC-TV in Memphis, Action News 5 investigators recently discovered 90 girls who attend Fraser High School are now pregnant or have already had a baby this school year. The sources told Action News 5, I just can't get over how they write these TV stations. Sources told Action News 5 there's a massive initiative in the works dedicated to preventing teen pregnancy in the Fraser community. I've got an initiative. It wouldn't even have to be big. Close the school. The initiative will include after-school and in-school programs funded with grant money run by some local nonprofit. That's what we need, is we need the children mingling after school, before school, even during school. Let's get the boys and girls together some more, and we can teach them how to avoid getting pregnant. Anyway, Memphis City School Board member Stephanie Gatewood had this to say. She said, noting that our young ladies absolutely did not get pregnant in the hallways of our schools, everything that happens in our communities just spills over into the schools, she said. So, Ms. Gatewood, may I ask, how do you know that these girls didn't get pregnant in the hallways of your schools? Can you prove that? Because I would hazard a guess that I would bet a half a dozen or more of them actually got pregnant in the hallway of your schools. Here we have a young, poor, ignorant child in the school, a young lady named Tarika Sutton. She was 5 months pregnant when she found out that she was pregnant. Her parents and classmates were stunned. Stunned! Here's what Tarika says, this poor child. I hate to make fun of this poor child. Tarika says, all my friends, they were like, Tarika, I never knew you'd get pregnant. And I was like, well, it happened. Unquote. First of all, how are any of her friends shocked? You got 90 girls pregnant, and I mean, one more turns up pregnant. How does that shock anybody? Anyway, these poor, ignorant children, they just don't know any better. They're like lambs being led to the slaughter in these government schools. It's despicable. By the way, Tarika says she believes some girls are making agreements with each other to get pregnant. Tarika says, quote, they need a class where they can teach girls before they get pregnant to use protection and stuff. And don't be trying to get pregnant. Unquote.
She's smart.
Don't try to get pregnant. That's Tarika's first line of advice for you. So what do you think? You think these high school girls could be doing this to get a welfare check? Is that possible? Or are they just so ignorant and just miseducated and just spiritually blind that they just don't know what they're doing, and it's just a disaster? All right, I'm almost out of time. Radio stations in Canada, according to Reuters, radio stations in Canada have been warned to censor the 1985 Dire Straits song, Money for Nothing, after a complaint. A radio station should have edited the song, according to the Canadian Broadcast Standards Council, because of the use of the word faggot. An unnamed listener to some FM station complained to the Canadian Broadcast Standards Council, no doubt some faggot. The council said it realized that Dire Straits used the word sarcastically, and its use might have been acceptable in 1985, but it is now inappropriate. So welcome to Orwell's world, folks. You can't use the word faggot anymore, even if it's a joke, like in that song. Let's see here. Ron Cohen, who's the council of the Canadian Broadcast Standard Council, he's the chairman, he says the decision doesn't really relate to the Dire Straits song at the end of the day. The decision relates to the word in question. The word which shall not be tolerated anymore. The ruling comes in wake of an uproar sparked by a U.S. scholar who decided to publish an edition of Mark Twain's novel, Huckleberry Finn, that would remove the word nigger to make it less offensive to some readers. Did I say the N-word? I apologize. I'll probably be censored in Canada. We could have Canadian officials knocking at our door any moment. He used the two words that shall not be used. All right. Well, folks, we're almost out of time. Let's see. Now, here's one from the French press agency. Protesters in Brazil claim the recent designation of a homosexual transgendered-only toilet at Carnival on the premises of one of Rio's top samba schools resembles the forced separation of blacks and whites in the past. Claudio Nascimento, who's the head of a government anti-homophobia program, told reporters, "This is Carnival apartheid." Now, defenders of the segregated toilets argue that they provide a safe area for homosexuals and transvestites, other perverts, and deviants. But gays, lesbians, bisexuals, and transgendered people are upset, even though, according to officials, they can still opt to go to regular toilets. So it's to me, it's the straights who should be protesting. How come you're allowing the queers to use our toilets and we can't go use their toilets? Because, I mean, if you're at Carnival, you walk into the toilet, and there's a couple of faggots in there. I mean, that can be... That can ruin your whole Carnival. Let's see. It has also recently come to light that four other samba schools in Rio de Janeiro, four other samba schools have already introduced separate toilets for homosexuals, transgendered, and all that other stuff. And so there you have it. State of all right. These other two stories are too disgusting for me to do. In light of that last story about the samba schools and the transgendered toilets, I simply can't do it to you anymore, ladies and gentlemen. That's it. That's the Weekly Worldview for this week. I want to thank my friends at KGOV, at TheologyOnline.com, at Personhood USA, and, of course, American Right to Life, and, as always, my other brother, Daryl, who makes it all happen here in the Weekly Worldview studios. I'll be back with you next week, should the Lord tarry. And until then, may the grace of God go with you, and may the peace of Jesus Christ be upon you.